Hello and welcome to the Monocle Weekly on Monocle 24 with me, Tom Edwards, and Fernando Augusto Pacheco.
On today's show, we'll be meeting Jason Blum, founder of Blumhouse Productions. We discuss their latest film, The Invisible Man, and the rise of horror.
Then we meet musician Hannah Lu from Cold Beat.
And we'll speak with acclaimed French author Leila Slimani about her latest book, Sex and Lies.
All that coming up, plus Monocle's Chiara Rimella will be looking ahead to next week's news today, and we've more great music for you too, right here on the Monocle Weekly on Monocle 24. Here we are, Fernando. Happy Sunday lunchtime to you.
I love a Sunday at this hour, just to be here with you, Tom.
It's very nice.
Exactly.
We don't want to be with our families. We want to be here in the studios. No, but in all seriousness, what a show. We've got literary luminaries. And I know, Fernando, we're talking horror. The rise and rise, the constant ascent of horror in cinemas, something that you're very interested in.
I was so happy meeting Jason because he's a very smart guy, because all of his films, the budgets are quite small, including The Invisible Man, which I've seen, and by the way, very good film, and the critics, you know, they really loved it as well. I think he only spent, you know, less than $10 million, but the visual effects, they're so smart, he's got good talent, so it is quite impressive that you can do quite a lot with, you know, not a big Hollywood budget.
What else has caught your eye? Been a busy news week. Anything in the cultural firmament you've noticed?
Well, I've got to be honest. I mean, of course, I'm sure our Monocle listeners, they're very cool and everything. But, you know, there's always space for trash, Tom, because I am addicted to this love reality show called Love is Blind. I don't know, I shout at TV when it's on. They are very smart, the producers of this TV show, because it's so addictive. It's like crack.
So there you go. Other hardcore drugs are available.
Yeah. Oh, maybe.
And in a televisual format also. Why is it so Moorish, just like its crack counterpart?
Because, you know, you have all this group of interesting Americans there, and they basically fall in love before they see each other. They talk through a wall. And after 4 days, they're already, like, proposing to each other. They say, I love you. I never loved someone like you, even only after 4 days. So it's all very dramatic. And there's one scene that you would love. One of the characters, Jessica, she was drinking wine, and then she offered to her dog as well. So she basically shares a glass of wine with her golden retriever. That's a classic scene of a reality show.
Fernando, I'm never going to watch this. It sounds like complete garbage. However, I'm sure our global audience will take your advisories on board. What were you talking about? We love trash. We want to up the trash quotient. Let's do it right now and get even trashier. As we look at the week ahead, here comes Chiara Rimella. Chiara, welcome. It's a festival of trash. Now, you're here to raise the tone and give us some hard, serious grown-up news. Are you going to deliver on that? What have you got for us?
Speaking of trash, Brexit.
Oh, no.
Great.
And specifically in its passport iteration. So I'm sure you've all been waiting for this moment, probably waiting for the moment you could file your own request. But the blue passports are coming for British citizens from March. And it's a momentous occasion because they're becoming blue.
And am I right in thinking that there was a traditional British passport making company, I think they also make money and all the rest of it, who were in the running? They've been overlooked. And it's being outsourced, of course, to a European country.
Yeah, obviously this is...
Drink in the irony.
Yes. Sometimes these ironic stories are just a little bit too good to be true. And in this case, the new passports will be made by a Franco-Dutch company at a factory in Poland.
I mean, this is better and better.
The only good thing about this, I have to say, guys, it's blue. I think blue passports actually look quite good in
a
way.
I don't have a problem with blue passports. I think they do look pretty smart. I have an Italian one myself, so I'm a burgundy girl. But what I will say is that I find it very interesting that Priti Patel has said that she's so glad this is happening because once again, the passports will be entwined with national identity. Now, I'm not quite sure why a blue passport should be naturally entwined with British identity, especially when you consider there are lots of other countries around the world that have blue passports.
Brazil.
Exactly.
We have a blue passport.
The United States is blue, isn't it?
Yes, and Australia, Iceland, Israel, and plenty more.
Are we throwing it out there that Priti Patel is maybe not the sharpest tool in the box?
I would never say that on a broadcasting platform.
It's on a broadcasting platform and I'm saying it and I'm repeating it. Where to next?
So I'd like to head to Europe's northernmost and longest sled dog race.
Is this in Norway?
Yes, of course. You've been following the activities of Finnmark Sloppet?
Which kind of dog do they use for that?
Huskies.
Of course.
Takes place on Friday the 6th. Starts in Alta, midway point in Kirkenes, and back to Alta for a grand total of 1,200 kilometres.
1,200 kilometres. Now tell me, presumably, how long do you have to tackle this route? 1,200 clicks, that's quite far.
I guess the expected arrival is about 5-6 days after the beginning of the race. And there's no official breaks. There's rest points, obviously, because you can't just... Yeah. The dogs can't run for six days straight. And obviously there's vets on the side.
I was going to ask whether any animals are harmed in the making of this sled dog race.
Obviously, they're very keen to highlight that the animals are very well looked after, and if they're really tired, they get to stay under a blanket on the sled itself and rest for a bit.
That's
until
nice.
They're ready.
Do the other ones of their doggy companions keep going?
Yes.
Is this true? And one has a breather?
This is what I understand. Unfortunately, and I have to admit this is not my first-hand experience. I have never attended Finnmark Sloppet.
Okay.
But
first time for everything.
Exactly.
Maybe they weren't a glass of wine at the end of the dogs, I mean.
That's true. Yeah. Does that help them? It's very bad for dealing with the cold, isn't it, in fact?
Well, it's quite interesting because I was reading on Finnmark Sloppet's website that this time of year is quite conducive to such a race because the temperature is quite cold. The coldest temperature on record is only minus 44 Celsius. So that's
balmy.
So that's ideal for 6 days out in the snow.
The dogs, are they wearing jackets, anything like that? They just wear their regular doggy pelts. That's it.
I mean, I guess they keep themselves warm with all their legwork.
They're used to it.
That's extraordinary, though, isn't it?
Yeah.
But there's 119 teams taking part. The Norwegians obviously have the biggest contingent because, you know, they've got
national pride
and advantage.
Sure.
But you're pleased to know there's also 3 Swiss teams.
Swiss are getting amongst it.
Some Swedes, Finns, and some Brits as well.
Plucky Brits.
No Italians.
Sadly not.
What a shame.
Is that a travel restriction related? Or they're just not heading up there?
I just don't know where they can practice sled dog racing.
A fair point, well made. What do you get if you win? Just the glory.
I hope that the idea of carrying a team of 14 husky dogs to the win is enough to warrant participating in
the glory of participation.
Finally, Kara, I think it's time to unplug a little bit, no?
All of us need to unplug. Fernando, most of all, he's so stressed.
I've been telling him that for some time.
With all that Love Is Blind watching. And
yes.
That
weird. We need to talk about that quite urgently, Fernando. But maybe not on air. But go on. Where's this headed?
Okay, so on Friday, if you're not following the sled dog race, then you should probably unplug. It's National Day of Unplugging in the US.
Is this a digital detox thing or is it some kind of medical procedure?
No, it is a digital detox. We're not asking you to electrocute yourself by trying
just
to
checking, just
unplug
checking.
A toaster or anything like that. No, so what's interesting, I think, about this day is that it's actually organised by an organisation called Reboot, which is an arts and culture non-profit with an aim to reinforce Jewish traditions. And now you might ask yourself, what is this about? Well, this is a bit of a reinterpretation of Shabbat, where you can't use your electronic devices from sundown to sundown. Religious connotations aside, I think it's a useful exercise to just not stare at your screen for a little bit. What I do find quite funny is that on the official website of the National Day of Unplugging, the organisation also offers resource kits to help with this occasion.
They have an app that you can use.
It's quite funny because they say they can provide you with kits with conversation starters or guides to unplugging activities.
Go on, what's the great unplugging conversation starter?
I feel like you're the kind of person who
may have to go and click on that myself and find out. Listen, generally, a bit of digital detox is surely a very good idea.
Oh, completely. In the spirit of digital detox, I brought my phone into the studio with me because I would never go anywhere without it, obviously. I have my own screen time report and I'm doing really badly. I have an average of 3 hours and 22 minutes per day.
That is fairly high.
It's quite bad, isn't it?
Anyone else, Fernando?
Well, I have something against that, actually, because it just makes us more stressed, because then we know how much we're consuming.
So how bad's yours, then?
It's quite similar to you guys. It is quite bad as well. I do feel a little bit smug when it says, it went down like 10% compared to last week as well. I was like, see?
Yeah. It's like all of the reading that I've done at the weekend. Ugh!
Yes.
So there you go. We've got some takeaways for the week. Digital detox. Get involved with sled dog or dog sled racing and get yourself passports in every shade of the rainbow.
I think that if your passport is due for renewal, then you're up for excellent surprises.
There you go. And what better and more excellent surprise could there have been? And kicking off the show with Chiara Rimella, thank you, Chiara, for sharing the secrets of next week's news today. Plenty to look forward to. Still on the Monocle Weekly in a moment, we'll be hearing from Leila Slimani talking about her new book, Sex and Lies. Don't go away. French-Moroccan author Leila Slimani's first novel, La Chanson Douce, or for those outside the Francophone world, Lullaby, propelled her to literary stardom. Her most recent work, however, is not of the psychological thriller variety, though shocking it often remains.
First published in 2017, but only now translated into English, Sex and Lies tells the complex tales of the Moroccan women who must navigate a society which polices and punishes their sexual choices and denies them the right to love and live as they please. Earlier this week, Leila Slimani joined Monocle's Paige Reynolds in the studio and started by explaining how the concept for her first non-fiction work was born.
Yeah, I was on a promotion tour in Morocco with my book Adele. It's a fiction about a woman who is a sex addict. And at the end of a conference in Rabat, a woman came to me and she said, "Can I sit next to you? I would like to tell you my story." And she told me about her divorce, her life, and her sexual life. And she told me how hard it is for a woman in Morocco today to have a free sexual life. And at the end of this conversation, it reminded me actually of my own childhood, of my own experience as a teenager in Morocco. And so I decided to write something about that. And more of that, I decided to interview a lot of women and ask them, how is it to be a woman today in Morocco? And how do you manage to have a free sexual life in a country where extramarital sex is forbidden?
What I found important about the way that you sort of presented these stories is you weren't really paraphrasing them or kind of making any generalizations. It was these women's words kind of as they said them. How important was that for you?
It was very important because I wanted people to really hear them, to really listen their words, to listen to the hesitation, to listen also the fact that sometimes they are ashamed, sometimes they don't find the word they want, they feel embarrassed in front of me, and I wanted really the reader to feel that. And sometimes also I could feel that they were proud to speak out. They were proud to say this is my story and I'm going to tell you and I don't want to feel ashamed. I want people to know that I assume my freedom and my life. So it was very important for me. And also I just won the Prix Goncourt when I wrote the book. So I knew that I had a voice at this moment and that people were going to listen to me. But I wanted to give this platform to other women and to tell them, use me because I can give you the opportunity for people to listen to you.
You talk about when this book was initially published in French, there was a lot of debate and it, I guess, propelled you to a bit more of a public role in terms of being a champion for women's rights in Morocco. Do you ever feel a sense of pressure before or the pressure to be more kind of on the ground? What's your kind of opinion on that?
No, the only pressure I feel is when I think about the people who are in jail because they have sexual intercourse, when I think about homosexual in jail because they are homosexual, when I think about women getting abortion in very, very bad condition, that's the only pressure I feel. I feel that I can't stay silent knowing all that and knowing in which situation they are. So, yes, I'm outraged by this injustice, and that's the only pressure I feel. I don't really care about the rest, and I don't care about myself and what people think about me. I don't care. I care about what do they think about the fact that people go to prison because of those laws.
As you're touching on there, it's the laws that seems really, really immovable. And I guess in contrast to a lot of the feminist movement in the West, it's about changing attitudes and increasing awareness. So how much of the fight in Morocco is about practically kind of making legislative changes?
I think that's the priority today, is to change the law. Everyone is telling me, no, you know, you should wait. Society is not ready for that. You should wait 10, 20, 50 years maybe. But I really don't believe that, because I think that no society should be ready for abortion in this condition or for a homosexual in prison. No society should be ready for that. So, of course, we need to change the law. That's why a few months ago I published a manifesto in France with 400 people saying we are outlaws, we are having sexual intercourse and we are not married. I had an abortion and I assume it. So if you want to put me in jail, put me in jail. So I think it's very important to say that to the authorities. Okay, you want to enforce the law? You will have to build a very, very big prison, because actually we are all outlaws. And that's the hypocrisy also that outrage me. And I think it's a scandal that a whole society is forced to lie and to pretend. There is no shame in making love.
There are many barriers to those laws changing. One of them, and correct me if I pronounce this wrong, is it Khashuma?
Exactly. So, you pronounce it very well.
Okay. And that's this sort of concept of shame. Maybe you could explain a little bit more about how that trickles down.
Yes, in our education as Moroccan, we are thought to be ashamed all the time. It's not something that is always negative. There is a positive way of being ashamed. When you want to say to a child, be polite, you say you should be ashamed. When you come to someone, you don't sit before the people tell you you can sit. So there is always this shame. But I think that women are much more ashamed than men. They are supposed to be ashamed of their body, of their desire, of the way they behave. And it's a burden on the shoulders of women. And it's very difficult to look at people, at your family, at your neighbors, and to tell them, you know what, I'm not ashamed. I'm not ashamed of my body. I'm not ashamed of my life. And those three women I interview in the book, very often they tell me at the beginning I was not ashamed, telling people I don't care. But then when you are a pariah, when you are marginalized, you are ashamed anyway.
And then I guess you just have to break with so much. It's not just about
exactly, yeah,
your own freedom. What I found really interesting, and something that I wasn't really aware of, is that, you know, sexual freedom and the erotic weren't always incompatible with Islam. And you mentioned that in the golden age of Islam and in the 1500s, sex wasn't really taboo at all. So, you know, when did this all change?
I think it changed mostly during colonization and just after. Because even just before colonization, in the beginning of the 20th century, the feminist movement in the Arab world was really strong in Egypt or in Tunisia. In the 19th century or 18th century also, erotism, homosexuality was accepted by a lot of Muslim societies. But I think that colonization was a real trauma for our societies, and especially for men, because they had the feeling that the white male has penetrated not only the territories, but their women, their sister, their mothers, and that in front of the woman they were humiliated. Their culture, their virility were humiliated. So I think that now this conservative vision of sex, of women, of society, is also a kind of revenge against the Western culture, saying we don't want to be like you, we don't want to lose our traditions and our old culture, and we are against this occidentalization of the whole world, and we will fight against that. I think that globalization also is maybe in cause in this conservative vision of sex.
It's kind of interesting, and a follow-on from what you're talking about with colonization. I noticed in the book that often this idea of Western interference was sort of wheeled out as an excuse by the authorities for saying we don't want to change the laws. But do you think there is a valid kind of fear to that idea that it's a Western import? Does the approach to reform in Morocco specifically need to be a bit more homegrown?
Yes, I think so. I can understand the fact that people are afraid of the West and of this power of globalization where every country will become the same and a sort of standardization of the world. And people need also to look into their own tradition, their own culture, their own history to find the solution to those problems. But I think also that the conservative and the Islamist, they manipulate people, telling them, you know, look at the West, that they hate you, they hate Islam, they hate immigrants, they are racist, and now you can't go there because you need visa. So yes, they are our enemies. I think we should be very careful with that, and I hate that. I don't think that we are forced to be enemies. I'm half French, half Moroccan, and all the time, you know, when I'm in France, I'm too Moroccan, and when I'm in Morocco, I'm too French. So I know that, and I know how my opponents are always using that and manipulating this argument. So no, I think that we can live together. I'm the proof of that. I'm a mix of the two cultures and I live well.
Yeah, you kind of have this perfect window
absolutely.
See both sides.
Yeah.
You also talk about directly in the book the relationship between this kind of mass sexual depravity and the Arab Spring. Some of the people you speak with outline it as one of maybe the major causes. Can you talk a bit about this?
Yes, what was very surprising to me when I was a reporter, I was in Tunisia in 2010 and 2011 at the beginning of the revolution. And when I was speaking to young Tunisians, they were telling me about their problems, of course, unemployment and discrimination and all that, the absence of cinema, of divertissement and things like that. But most of all, they were saying to me, you know, we have nothing, we are poor, we are unemployed, and we can't have a sexual life, and we can't have a girlfriend, and we can't just go to the cafe with our girlfriend because we are afraid of being arrested. And they felt that it was a humiliation, and especially men, because, you know, they try to find some money to take a girl to a cafe, and then they are arrested by a policeman or humiliated, and they have to pay him not to go to prison. And I think that's something that, when they speak about this attempt to their dignity, I think that sex is very important in this matter.
What you were saying there as well about it's affecting people also who are usually of an economically lower class as well.
Oh yes, I have a very Marxist vision of sexuality in this book, because I know that when you are a bourgeois, when you have enough money to have a house, a car, when you can travel and when you can afford a visa to go to Europe, you have actually the same sexuality as in Paris or in London. You can be a homosexual if you want. You can have an abortion because you can travel abroad to have this abortion. But when you are a woman, when you are poor, when you live in a suburb or in the countryside, your sexual life is going probably to be a tragedy, and it is going to be miserable.
You left Morocco, was it about 15?
When I was 18.
When you were 18. Was it a shock for you when you went to France that women were more free sexually, or was that something that you sort of knew about? What was the transition like?
No, it was quite a shock. The shock was the fact that I discovered that I could live very peacefully in the public space, that I could walk in the street during the night, that I could sit alone on a terrace in a cafe and have a glass of wine, smoke cigarette, and that no one is going to look at me or judge me or ask me any question, where is your father, where is your brother, and that I could meet someone just in the street, and if I decide to have a relationship with him, I can go with him and no one is going to ask me a question. So yeah, I discovered the fact that I can live without social pressure or without people judging me.
And of course, you know, and rightly so, a lot of this book is quite doom and gloom. But are there reasons for hope as well? Did you find those through the book?
Of course. And you know, when you're an activist, when you fight, you're forced to hope, to have hope and to be optimistic. Because if you say there's no hope, your opponents are winning. You give them the victory, and I will never do that. So, of course, I'm optimist because I believe in what I fight for, and I believe that it's fair, and I believe that it's true. And I think that the young people in Morocco, of course, they give me so much hope. You know, they are so inventive, and they want to be in love like every young people in the world, and they want to have sex, and they have so much desire, and I think they want to change their country and they want to change the world, and I will be there for them.
finally, what are the next steps with this kind of project? Because it does feel sort of separate from your fiction work. Are you kind of going to do more collections of essays? What's the next vision?
No, after the manifesto, I told you about the manifesto of the outlaws. We decided to do a petition, and this petition is now in the Moroccan parliament. And I had a conversation with the chief of the parliament, and I asked him about the possibility of changing the law. So now we have a very, very big group, and we have a little media on Instagram, on Facebook, and we're trying to convince more and more and more and more people. So I believe that maybe we're going to change the law, especially the law of abortion first, and then decriminalizing the sexual relationship. And the next step is homosexuality, but it's the hardest because it's very, very taboo.
I'm just surprised you have enough time in the
day. I don't. I'm very tired. I'm exhausted.
That was Leyla Slimani there, and Leyla's book Sex and Lies is out now. You're listening to the Monaco Weekly on Monaco 24. Tom, I think it's time for some new music.
I would love to hear a track, Fernando. What have you got for me?
We have Never Come Back by Canadian musician Caribou.
That was Never Come Back by Caribou. His album Suddenly is out now, and you can read Fernando's review of that album in the latest issue of Monocle, available, of course, at monocle.com and in all good newsstands now. You're listening to the Monocle Weekly on Monocle 24.
Blumhouse Productions was founded by Jason Blum back in 2000. Since then, the production company had a string of small-budget box office successes, such as Paranormal Activity, The Purge, and of course, Oscar-winning Get Out. And now the company brings to us a revisited version of The Invisible Man, starring Elizabeth Moss.
The film is out in most markets this weekend. Fernando spoke with Jason about the film and also about the ascendancy, the rise and rise and rise of horror in contemporary cinema.
Jason Blum, what a pleasure to meet you. First of all, the film is amazing, The Invisible Man. Tell us, how did you get involved with the project first?
You know, I've worked with Lee Whannell. It's our seventh movie together. We've been friends for 10 years. We've worked together for 10 years. And I really wanted to try one of the monsters, whether it was Dracula or Frankenstein, The Invisible Man. And I kept saying to Lee, would you like to do any of these? And he kept saying no. But actually, it was someone else who brought up to him Invisible Man. And he said, that's something that I could see doing. And he went away for a month and he came back with this idea, which is really the movie that you saw. His original idea is very close to the film that we shot. And as soon as he said the idea, we all loved it. I loved the idea of making a movie called The Invisible Man, actually about his victim, who's the woman, and about making the Invisible Man evil, and this guy who was gaslighting this woman. That concept was fits so well into The Invisible Man, the idea of The Invisible Man, and we loved it, and he wrote the script and we made the movie.
And you mentioned gaslighting. To be honest, that's something that I haven't seen in many recent horrors. So that's what I was quite surprised about. So he's not just kind of this monster, hey, I'm the Invisible Man. So he felt, actually, the beginning of the film, it's so scary. You don't even know, I mean, who he is, what he has done to her, but you could feel the tension in the air. That was a brilliant opening sequence.
Yeah, I thought so too, and there's even at one point the gas on the stove goes off. There's a literal gaslight, which I like. Lee is a wink to the audience. But the movie is, in a funny way, it's a throwback to an actress would star in these thrillers in the 90s, like Fatal Attraction, and then a whole series of them came from Paramount, actually. And the movie, in a cool way, is kind of tips its hat at those movies that I grew up with.
And it's interesting, Jason, I don't know if you noticed, do you think finally people are respecting horror for what it is? And do you think, because in the past, perhaps some parts of the press, they had some sort of prejudice against horror, but I mean, one of your great films as well, like Get Out. I mean, nominated for many Oscars. And I have a feeling the critical acclaim for Invisible Man will be quite similar to that in a way.
Well, I hope you're right. I think Get Out definitely changed a lot of people's perception about horror. We got out of the ghetto a little bit. It certainly made more artists who wouldn't have worked in horror more attracted to try working in horror movies, whether it's actors or writers or directors. And I also think in a funny way, Get Out kind of laid the groundwork for Parasite getting all the attention that it did. I feel like Get Out gave permission to people to say, hey, it's okay to recognize horror as great art. That really helped Parasite, which makes me happy because I thought Parasite was a great movie.
When you found Blumhouse Productions, did you know already that you wanted kind of to focus a little bit on horror? I know that it's not only horror, but clearly there is a, you know, it's one of the specialities of the house, right, in a way.
When I founded the company, I think I really loved making independent movies, but I hated independent distribution. I wanted studio distribution. And the way you could get studio distributed independent movies was horror. And that was really what I learned from Paranormal Activity was, and what I'm glad that I decided to do is after Paranormal, a lot of people encouraged me to make more expensive movies. And I resisted that and instead continued to make low budget, scary movies. And to this day, although the movies are different and the little things are different, the core of what we do on the movie side remains very much the same. The big difference now is that half of our business now is television. When I started, we didn't have a television business.
And it's interesting when you mention about the budget, because it's true. I mean, Hollywood is spending more and more in films, the Marvel films, which of course they tend to do well, but so does horror. Correct me if I'm wrong, what is the budget of The Invisible Man? Because I've seen it. And the visual effects, they are, you know, cool. Some might say they're not, you know, the most expensive in the world, but it's so effective, yeah, and it's believable and really stayed with me.
Yeah, the budget was $7 million, so very inexpensive. And I actually think not all kinds of movies, but genre movies are better when they're lower budget. If big budget genre movies, then the director kind of relies on special effects to scare people. And I don't think special effects are ever as scary as human interaction. And true, there are effects in The Invisible Man, but really the effects are making something that you can't see. So it makes a lot of sense that Blumhouse's first monster movie would be The Invisible Man, because it's actually the one monster movie that is, the lack of effects is what makes it scary as opposed to the other way around.
We were talking about praise for horror these days. What about actors? I mean, you have Elizabeth Moss, a fantastic actress. Are they also more open to do those projects, like The Invisible Man, for example?
After Dangan was recognized by the Academy, and then after that, and Us helped too. You know, we produced Us, and that's when I first met Elizabeth, and I'd always been a big fan of hers. I think she's an amazing actress, and clearly I feel like the movie, you know, she's so much a part of the movie and a part of the DNA of the movie. It never would have worked as well. I think I can't imagine any other actress in that part or any other actress doing as good of a job as Elizabeth did in that part. And yes, one of the big benefits of horror in a post-Get Out world is there's a whole pool of actors who never would have considered doing a horror movie who now really are interested in doing them.
Do you think one of the secrets for the success of your films, you know, from what I've been reading, you give quite a lot of freedom, you know, to the directors or the film thing. So you're not that like, oh, don't do that because of commercial reasons or whatever. Right. Is that the case?
Yeah, I think the it's tied to low budget. When you're not risking a lot of money, you have the ability to give the director much more creative control than they ordinarily get in Hollywood. Our system is actually kind of, it's a European system. It's auteur filmmaking, but applied to commercial movies, not art house movies. And the funny thing about that is as soon as the director knows that his or her decision is the final decision, they're much more likely to collaborate because they bring up what they're worried about or what they ask us questions. The creative conversation is much more fruitful as a result of relinquishing control.
And I have a feeling, I mean, you have such a busy 2020. I mean, just in the coming months, I mean, you have The Invisible Man, Fantasy Island, you have The Hunt as well, Halloween later this year. I mean, The Purge, which, again, is one of my favorites. I do love The Purge, I have to say. But how are you feeling? And it's interesting, they are horror, but they are quite different ideas of a film. I think Fantasy Island perhaps is a bit, I haven't seen the film, so it's a bit more cheeky, you know, and then perhaps The Hunt, touches of comedy, The Invisible Man, you know, touches very serious topics. So they're different in their own ways.
Yeah, I think the kind of movies we're making now are different. I think to get people into a movie theater to see a genre movie, it has to really feel like a special event. It really has to differentiate ourselves. I think when the company first started, it was a lot of like a family in a house and scary things happen. The first Purge was like that. The first Sinister was like that. The first Insidious was like that. Paranormal Activity, that's what it was. And I love all those movies, but I don't know if any of those movies would get people to a theater today. Today, it has to feel different than anything you've ever seen before, like Halloween did, or Get Out does, or I think Invisible Man does, I think The Hunt does, I think the upcoming Purge will. So the company, you know, what we're looking for is not, you know, down the middle horror, which we did for a long time.
If you may say something, you know, The Hunt caused so much controversy like last year, perhaps, you know, for weird reasons. But how are you feeling that it's finally going to be released? I mean, are you relieved? I mean, are you okay with all this controversy?
I could have lived without the controversy. I'm very happy that it's coming out. I'm incredibly proud of the work that Damon did in the movie, that Betty does in the movie, Hilary Swank. I'm very proud of what those guys made with this movie. And it was incredibly disappointing to think that no one may ever see it. So when we got it, when we all figured out how to get it back into the world, it made me very happy. And like I said, I'm really looking forward to when it's finally in theaters and I get to hear people, you know, I get to see people's responses to it because I love it, but it definitely is going to make people talk.
And it's funny that horror, again, it's definitely not a kind of film that only does well in America. I think it's such an international genre. I know in my own country, Brazil, horror is massive and your films do well. There's something internationality about that in a way, right? Yeah.
Well, I think we all like being scared, whether you're from Brazil or France or Korea. Our movies do particularly well in Indonesia, strangely. There are a few territories that our movies don't necessarily do well, but still, scary movies do well pretty much everywhere. They may be only local. In Japan, it's more local movies. But I think we have a universal desire to feel our adrenaline pumping and to be exhilarated and to be scared. Not everybody, but a lot of people. And that crosses all nationalities and all borders.
But is it true? I've read somewhere that at the beginning, you were not like the biggest horror fan. Is that the case? Or I mean, you liked all films in a way. But
yeah, no, that is true. That is true. I now love horror because it's what I do. But I learned to love it. I learned to love it from our filmmakers. I learned to love it. I love the horror community. By far, my favorite people to hang out in the movie business are people who are involved in horror movies, for sure. But I really liked all kind of movies, and then horror's obviously found a place in my heart because it's a way to tell, I think, you know, we kind of use horror as a way to tell different interesting stories that you might not get into a movie theater without making them scary.
And sorry, I know it's a bit too early to say, but, you know, I am a big fan of Halloween. I mean, can you say anything about the film that's going to be released later this year?
Yeah, well, I just saw it. I saw it a couple weeks ago. Yeah, I just saw it for the first time, and I'm incredibly happy with it. Jamie Lee Curtis is amazing, and it's David Gordon Green and Danny McBride came back. It feels bigger than the first movie that we did. The scale of the movie is very big. It's super intense. It's super violent, and I loved it.
And finally, Jason, just would like to ask, it's interesting that people, you know, I know you have work with TV as well. Everybody talks about streaming, but it's so funny how your films do very well actually in the cinema. You know, people are going and buying. You know, there's so many articles, oh my God, the crisis at the box office. I mean, it's not the case with your films in a way. What do you have any views on that when it comes to streaming and what's happening in the industry right now?
I think the kind of movie that plays in the movie theaters is narrowing. I think there's only a very certain, it's like, you know, the kind of, it has to be, whether it's a horror movie or not, it has to feel like an event. It has to feel like it's worth leaving Netflix for to go see. And that's made the theatrical movie, it's made making the movies more challenging and you have to distinguish them. I don't think the theatrical experience is ever going away. I think it's changing fast. I don't think it's ever going away. I think streaming is another option, but I don't think it's going to replace the theatrical experience as much as the invention of television did not replace the theatrical experience.
That was Jason Blum, and The Invisible Man is out now. I totally recommend him. You should go and watch it.
I know you're something of a horror devotee. They say, you know, don't meet your heroes and all the rest of it, but I sense from talking to Jason there that that's only probably further increased your fascination with the genre.
Absolutely. And it's so funny, Jason has so many films still to be released this year. There's the new Halloween as well, which will be out, of course, later this year. So lots of exciting plans for Blumhouse Productions.
And there's still more excitement to come on the Monocle Weekly. Don't go away. You're with the Monocle Weekly on Monocle 24. Tom Edwards and Fernando Augusto Pacheco in the chairs this week. Now, Oakland-based musician Hannah Lu has been releasing records as Cold Beat since the early 2010s and formally shaped her icy, crystalline take on melodic synth and guitar pop as part of San Francisco trio Grass Widow.
She's also known for her work as a filmmaker, releases music on her own label, Crime on the Moon, and finds the time as well to run local Oakland record shop, Contact Records. Cold Beat returned this year with new album Mada, released on DFA Records, and a bolstered lineup of musicians making the band fuller and more collaborative than ever before. Monica Stonehall recently spoke to Hannah Lu down the line to find out more.
So this record was actually written during the time, written and recorded, I should say, during the time I was pregnant with my son. It was a really tumultuous year. Just our environment and on so many levels was just really insane out here. There was lots of big fires going on. I actually had to like hole up in my house for like 2 weeks because it was so smoky. And then, you know, our president was Trump. And just everything, it was just such a crazy time. And I just found myself having a lot of things to write about because I usually use music writing as a way to kind of synthesize my feelings. And I was just feeling a lot. And then I actually put in the last two tracks to be mixed around 2 days before I gave birth. So it was really a time capsule of that time.
That's fascinating to hear that you were making the album while pregnant. I mean, did it affect your mindset while you were making the record? Did the record sort of idea change as that process went on?
Absolutely. I mean, there's some subject matter that's just hard to escape when you're thinking about bringing a human into the world. And I think I just had so many hopes and fears. And this really interesting thing happened, actually, which was that I had sent the tracks to Josh from Dark Entries, the record label here, and he was like, this record sounds good, but I'm noticing that a lot of the songs are in a similar BPM, and he had put all the songs through a BPM analyzer, and we realized that, because the baby's heartbeat, I think, is like between 120 and 140, and then it's doubled at the beginning of pregnancy, and then it like slows down throughout pregnancy to be a normal person's heart rate, but all the songs were subconsciously written within those BPMs, which was sort of, I guess, just a thing that happened. So I know that it seems really funny, but it just ended up being this tempo that held me to it. So all the songs, I was sort of just like tied to a tempo, a certain range of BPM, I think.
About some of the broader themes as well. I mean, you mentioned the wildfires and this sort of maybe sense of slightly impending doom, which a lot of us have about the whole climate situation. One of the singles off the record, Flat Earth, I was watching the video for it and I noticed, I don't know whether this was a DFA thing or a you thing, but I noticed in the description, rather than underneath it, it saying the typical, this is out on this date and blah, 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 it just had a really clear link to the Wikipedia description of like flat eartherism. And I wondered, is that a very deliberate choice just to sort of point out to people and try and sort of stem the spread of misinformation that we all seem to be absolutely mired in at the moment?
Well, I think that misinformation has been a really big part of all the chaos of the past few years. And I think that we're kind of living in a post-reality time where reality doesn't really mean much. It's like we're constantly looking at photos online of filtered images, and we don't even see a person's face without having a filtered image. It's almost like the whole world has plastic surgery all of a sudden. And there's just sort of this like, I don't know. I mean, there's always been misinformation in the news and everything, but I think that in the past few years, for me, I've noticed that it's beyond some kind of conspiracy theory. There's just really been a lot of people that will believe things that just aren't true. Like, that, you know, global warming is happening, for example. And I guess when I wrote the song, I was just sitting there in the midst of this Blade Runner looking like orange sky that lasted for like 2 weeks and just seeing the direct effects of global warming. And then it was during a specific time when a lot of people were denying global warming. And I was just like, this is insane. But what's really funny is that we posted the video on YouTube, and then the comment section is full of people that there were actually a few flat earth believers on there just saying things like, do your research, space is fake AF, like all this stuff. And I'm just like, wow, like, you know, I guess space could be fake AF. It's quite possible, but I'm definitely one of the people that believes that the earth is a globe.
Yeah, I agree. You may be glad to know. We'll swiftly get back to the music in a moment, but I just wanted to ask you, as you mentioned, I mean, you've recently had a child and you're sort of talking about the outlook for the world we're in at the moment and stuff. I mean, do you feel sort of optimistic about the future, about raising a kid in this environment that we've just been discussing, this sort of almost post-truth kind of thing?
Well, I was born in the Reagan era, so maybe there's hope that even though my son is born in a Trump era, he'll be okay. First of all, I just hope there's still clean water available for him by the time he's 10. That's like a real concern. I hope there's clean air and clean water.
It's a high bar we're going for, isn't it?
Yeah, it's just like people in much of the world don't have access to clean water right now, which is, you know, something that I'm grateful that we have access to, but I don't know how long that will last. So those are some real things that I think about, especially as we get accustomed to just having what we call fire season here in California and a lot of other parts of the world, including Australia. It's just not something we should be getting used to, but it's something we prepare for. We constantly have a supply of particle masks here, and that's a weird thing to have around. In terms of a political climate, I don't know what it will take for things to truly change. And I just really hope that things are very different than they are now by the time he gets a little older. But things have been bad and gotten good again, so it's possible. But I mean, it's that vacillation between total doom and a lot of hope that I think I just was feeling a lot while writing the record. And it's heightened when you're bringing another person in and you're responsible for another human and you're thinking about what you're bringing them into, because I do believe it could get a lot better, but it could easily get a lot worse.
We'll have to see. So let's talk about the band and the evolution of it, because, I mean, you've collaborated with loads of people in the past in different ways, but am I right in thinking this Cold Beat record is much more of a band record than previous ones?
For sure. So Kyle King has always been in the project from the very beginning, but the rest of the band has been playing with us for the past, I would say, 2.5 years or so. I mean, it was just pure magic, honestly. It was like, oh, these are the people that were supposed to be in the band the whole time. Like, it actually feels like Cold Beat for the first time. I feel really lucky to have found them, especially in the Bay Area, even though Sean technically lives in LA, but this is a town that people move away from and people rarely move to, because it's just so expensive. And so I just feel so lucky that I found the people that I collaborate with. It's just great to have people that are local, that actually live here and are invested in being here. Everyone's been part of the writing process, and they're just people that I fully trust. It's been really nice. I'm really glad with them, these people. I guess I'm still the boss. People are bringing ideas, and I think they're happy to have me bring the bulk of something. But also, like, there's exceptions, because there's definitely been a few songs that someone else brought and I just sort of added to. So one of those tracks is on the new record is Mother, the song that the album is actually named for as well. That was just a song that Sean had made. And then I just basically added vocals, and then we added stuff from there. But it was, I mean, of course, the song sounds a lot different with vocals and stuff, but that was one that he had just brought. People have contributed in different ways, but it's definitely still like, if there's a sound that I really don't like or something, I'll just be like, no. I love him so much. My bandmate Kyle King has been trying to sneak Koto drum sounds into our song for like years, and I've like repeatedly been like, no, I'm sorry.
I mean, we can talk about another influence, or at least someone with a big drum sound, the Eurythmics. You did a sort of EP of covers of the Eurythmics a couple of years ago. I've always found them a really difficult band to connect with psychologically. I think it's probably something to do with, I know that they started out in an interesting fashion and small and probably much more grimy, but my overall impression of them is the height of their stadium bombast. And I find it a very like, quite cold thing to try and connect with musically, but I really enjoyed your versions because I found you kind of humanized that a bit. What is it about the Eurythmics that you're a big fan of?
Well, I just want to say that I similarly, as I think everyone, probably the world, had the same experience you had with knowing their big hits and just sort of thinking about them in that way. I think what happened with me is that I heard the album In the Garden for the first time. And I had recognized a couple of tracks off of it, but I was just like, what is this record? It just like floored me. I was in the process at the time. This was before I was pregnant, or it was just between records. I was trying to write original material, and I just got so obsessed with that record. And I was like, just felt compelled to try to cover some songs. Also at the same time, I own a record shop here in Oakland called Contact Records, and I was doing a record buy, and I was just digging through all these early 4AD 12 inches, and there were some other things mixed in, and included in the 12 inch pile was the Jennifer 12 inch. And when you hear it on 45 RPM, just 12 inch, it just sounded so good. And it just, I think I just heard more pieces of the song than I ever had, and it just hit me really hard, and I just felt really compelled to cover the song. And then it turned into this thing where I was like, oh, but they have so many other amazing songs, and it just kind of opened my eyes, and I couldn't even write my own music for a minute. I just got obsessed with them. I learned about their early, how they recorded things. They were actually recording with a 388 drum machine in basically a closet, and they were just really working with what they had. You know, I think even some of their big hits were written at a time when they didn't have access to a big budget. And I just like had read this article actually about them. I think it was in Sound on Sound Mag or something. And just their whole process was just really interesting to me. And in doing the covers, I sort of like combed through track by track, just like thinking about how they did things. And it was just a really fun exercise. And I think for me, it really opened me up to different ways that I could write and just using different sounds I wouldn't have considered before. I think it really broadened my palette to do those covers. Yeah, I'm just got a little taste of like, oh, like how would someone else do something? And I was probably using really different equipment than they were, but it was definitely a fun exercise.
And Oakland, I mean, I read a previous interview with you and stuff, but it's also a vibe that I have picked up from other musicians. You mentioned it earlier, the insane rent prices and a lot of musicians maybe moving on. I mean, I think it had a really interesting time sort of around maybe like the beginning of the 2010s, and then a lot of people moved away from it and stuff. I mean, do you sort of see the ebb and flow of scenes like that while living there?
Not really. I think that big tech has just maybe made irreparable damage to the art and music scene here. It's just really hard. There's just this paradigm of super, super, super rich people and then like homeless people. And actually a lot of the homeless people here are San Francisco natives that I grew up with, including like my best friend's little brother who's been homeless for 14 years. It's a sad scene. I think that it would be a miracle if people in New were able to make enough money to move back here. The people I do know that live here live in some kind of exception or loophole where it's like, I found cheap rent and I'm sticking with it and I'm just stuck here with these golden handcuffs. I wouldn't say we have a huge local community because of that. And I think as a band, it's just become more global in terms of other bands that we share things with. I don't know. It's definitely not how it used to be. I mean, it could be a product of me getting older too, but I don't know. I definitely have had more friends move away and I can't think of anyone that's moved here.
Okay. I wanted to talk just really quickly about the record shop. What kind of records are you selling? Are you selling brand new or is it kind of like bought and sold, trading and stuff like that?
Yeah, it's mostly used. We're a really small shop. We're actually in a shipping container. So because we're so small, we have the luxury of only carrying things that we like. We have a lot of new stuff, but we're mostly used and we sort of specialize in collectibles and international music. We just got a bunch of records from Nigeria, a lot of really cool like disco and just really interesting stuff. And then we've gotten a lot of records from Japan as well. And it's a small shop, but it's packed with good stuff.
Has anyone ever come in with a box of kind of old stuff they're throwing out of their house and they're like, oh, there's a load of old records here and nobody wants them and there's a Cold Beat record in there and they don't know who runs the shop?
People definitely bought Cold Beat records or Grass Widow records and not realized. And I've just like once in a while, I'd be like, oh, that's my band. And people be like, what? You look like a slobby clerk though. And I'm like, yep, that's me.
I like the idea of you. I think you should just not tell them next time. You should just be like, it's really, really good. You're going to love this.
Yeah, good idea. I think I'll do that next time.
Hannah Lou of Cold Beat there, talking to Monocle's Tom Hall earlier. And that new Cold Beat album, Mother, is out on DFA Records now. Do track it down. This is the Monocle Weekly on Monocle 24.
Tom, what a great show. I really enjoyed.
Fernando, as always, light and shade. What better way to spend a Sunday lunchtime? And I feel I've got lots of inspiration, literary, musical, and all the rest to power me through the next few days. Yeah, very happy with that.
It was good to have Leila Slimani as well. I mean, she's honestly like one of the most popular and successful French authors at the moment.
Just an incredible talent. And I love it when people are as passionate and as inspiring when talking about their work as the work itself.
And of course we had horror as well, which is always a good thing.
It's always a horror, Fernando, when you're in the studio next to me. I joke, of course. No, great to hear your chat with Jason. A great show all round, for which we should be grateful. Let's thank the people that made it happen. This 557th edition of the Monocle Weekly was produced by Fernando, and our studio managers were Maile Evans, Jack Dewars, Louis Allen and Miles Blumson.
The Monocle Weekly will be back again next week, but for now, it's goodbye from me, Fernando Augusto Pacheco.
And from me, Tom Edwards.
Goodbye.